We now come to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all her government's statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes. Particularly the government's work to prevent COVID-19 going hard and early has put us in a good position. Many countries have not had the chance that we have had, have faced thousands of deaths and economies grinding to a halt regardless. These were the projections that we saw here too. Right now, we need to hold on to our hard-won gains and not allow the virus to bounce back. The next phase will be keeping on top of the virus as we start opening up economic activity. We need to continue our collective approach to make sure we stay safe, save lives and save livelihoods.
Prime Minister, assure New Zealanders that we will come out of level 3 in 2 weeks so that many more tens of thousands of Kiwis will be able to go back to work.
Mr. Speaker, that is our aspiration, but whether or not we succeed is actually not in the hands of anyone in this House, but actually in the hands of our team of almost 5 million. It will be a collective job. If we stick to the rules, we manage to keep away community transmission and stay in control of the virus, then our ambition is then, of course, to move to level 2.
Does she accept we can keep New Zealanders safe as well as get many more tens of thousands back into work than is currently the case at level 3?
Mr. Speaker, of course, at level 3, we get up into a position where we have economic activity at around 75%, so there is a significant return. What we need to, of course, weigh that up against are some of those areas of work, such as beauty therapy, or those that require close contact. At level 3, we are still trying to reduce that contact while we're really in a waiting room to really ensure that we don't have an uptick in the virus, that we don't put ourselves in a position where we yo-yo between levels. We want to get down further through the alert levels so that more economic activity can take place and so we don't end up back in lockdown.
Does she accept the urgency for businesses and jobs, such as the 10% of workers in retail, of getting out of level 3?
Mr. Speaker, I absolutely do. And I heard the member reference in his speech, making sure that we hear New Zealanders. We may not have been able to have face-to-face discussions with those operators and retailers, but we have been acutely aware of their needs and their desire to get back into a position where they're trading face-to-face again, because online offerings, I know, will never be a supplement for many people's current way of operating, Mr. Speaker. So that is our ambition. But equally, the Treasury modelling will show as well that we will be better off in the long run if we can get out and stay out of these more restrictive levels. That is our goal, and that is our goal so that we can continue, for instance, as Mr. Seymour pointed out, getting to a position where eventually we have large-scale events again, because those industries are severely impacted by where we are right now and even where we'll be at level 2.
Is she aware how many more New Zealanders are going on to the Job Seeker benefit or the Dole each week at the moment?
Mr. Speaker, of course, we are releasing more frequent information, and the last detail that I saw had an extra, from memory, about 7,000 people going on to Job Seeker. At the moment, Job Seekers as a percentage of the working age population represents about 5.8%. That is just a touch above where we saw at the GFC, and we have always indicated, as have commentators around the world, the impacts on employment here are likely to be worse than the GFC, and significantly so. Our job is to make sure we connect people, keep them connected to work, get them back into work as quickly as possible. Mr. Speaker, on that note, can I add that we've had over 2,000 people this month come off Job Seeker and into work. So even in lockdown, work has been underway by MSD to redeploy people to those areas of essential work, food production and processing, to keep people connected to the workforce.
Will the Prime Minister assure New Zealanders regarding our or the government's COVID-19 economic recovery that her way out will not include raising taxes or creating new ones?
Mr. Speaker, I've been asked that before and have already said that. In fact, if you'll see from our initiative so far, we've actually been providing tax relief. The first business tax package had tax deductions for assets that, for instance, often used to enable people to work from home. We raised the provisional tax threshold. We wrote off late tax penalties. We allowed building depreciation. We've added to that a second package worth $3.2 billion, including tax locks carryback, tax loss continuity support, and of course that sat alongside services like business consultancy services to make sure people are accessing all of those packages.
Does she accept for businesses, while the wage subsidy has been a welcome lifeline, they're still struggling to pay all of their costs like rent and rates, so that tens of thousands will go out of business and fire many tens of thousands of Kiwi workers before Budget 2020 if they don't receive more government support urgently?
Mr. Speaker, the first thing I'll say, we've never waited for the budget in order to move quickly to support business. And that's why you've seen a significant investment already to try and respond to need as we've seen it. The more than $10 billion wage subsidy scheme, I do want to point out, unlike other economies, like for instance Australia, we got that out the door within days. Australia is not yet paying their wage supplement, and so that's been incredibly important. The second difference, we have paid that out in bulk. So that was a 12-week payment that came right up front to support businesses that has given them the flexibility to manage their needs, with the only proviso that people keep connected to the workforce and that they keep paying people's wages. We did look at that other significant fixed cost for many businesses, which will be their rental costs, their lease arrangements. There, we made proviso for their arrears to be able to accumulate for a longer period before they're able to be terminated. There were limitations on what we were able to do in that area, though, Mr. Speaker. And finally, things like tax loss carryback is a significant initiative in order to help with cash flow issues for businesses as well, but we've never ruled out continuing our supplementary support, and that's what we've done all the way through.
David Seymour.
Can the Minister confirm for business owners that there will not be relief for commercial leases?
Mr. Speaker, we looked at all the options and we had limitations there on what we were able to do that did not exist for residential tenancy. But even if we can't do things that are directly attributable only to the fixed cost of commercial leases, what we have tried to do is deal with cash flow issues through, for instance, the tax system or through wage subsidies to try and help in other ways.
Those answers, can we expect more cash support, whether for rent or rates or otherwise, for businesses, particularly small businesses, imminently?
Mr. Speaker, we've always said we want to keep assessing the situation for our businesses. What we have looked at is, rather than some of the more generic support mechanisms and packages like wage subsidies, whether or not now is the time to look at more targeted offerings. I am very aware that, for instance, tourism, for those who work in large events, are going to be specifically affected for a longer period of time. So that's work that the government continues to do.
Is Phil Twyford's warning to councils last week that they must not provide relief to ratepayers on rates, in fact, government policy?
Speaker, I haven't read those explicit comments. What I will say generally, though, is, of course, councils have the issue that government has at the moment, where revenue streams for council have been impacted by COVID-19, but they have continuing ongoing costs. What I hope is that central government and local government will continue to work together to make sure that we have the stimulus we need in our economy to continue to create jobs, and local government has a role to play in that as well. And at the same time, I think we're all agreed, we want to lessen the burden of cost on our ratepayers and taxpayers at present, because this is a time where people are facing considerable potential costs, particularly if they've lost their jobs.
Twyford. Let me start again. Was Phil Twyford right, as reported in Stuff, I think last week, to tell council leaders that, quote, any move by councils to trim rates will impact the government's ability or willingness to invest in any proposed partnerships, end quote?
Speaker, again, I'd rather see the full context of Minister Twyford's statement. But also what I would point out is that there are a number of services and ongoing projects that councils, of course, are obliged to continue to deliver. But those are ultimately matters for them.
Question number two, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Speaker, my question to the Minister of Finance, does he stand by all his statements and policies?
Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Speaker, yes, in the context they were made and undertaken.
Can you explain to New Zealanders why so many people still can't go back to work when the Prime Minister says the virus is, quote, currently eliminated?
Well, I'm going to let the Minister answer it, but it doesn't actually flow from the question.
Mr. Speaker, I don't believe that's an accurate representation of what the Prime Minister said, and secondly, the Prime Minister has just outlined very clearly in her statement to the House the importance of doing this once and doing it right.
Does he remember Auckland Chamber of Commerce boss Michael Barnett begging his government to help struggling businesses with rent? And if so, why has there been no significant policy response so far?
Yeah. Ibid for my response. Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, I have regular conversations with Mr. Barnett, who I have a lot of respect for. We do know that nearly 70%, or probably more than 70%, of the $10 billion of the wage subsidy scheme has gone to small and medium enterprises who Mr. Barnett represents within the Auckland Chamber of Commerce. Many of the tax changes that have been proposed and will soon be passed through this House will also benefit those small and medium enterprises, and as the Prime Minister has just said, we continue to work with them on what else we may be able to do.
Why does he say that the wage subsidy has gone to small and medium-sized businesses when so many submitters this morning made the point that the wage subsidy has gone to the employees and the businesses themselves have actually received little in the way of cash support?
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure the member is well aware that the wage bill is the biggest bill of most small businesses.
Does it concern him that Rotorua bar operator Reg Hennessy at the committee this morning predicted that there will be a, quote, a huge shit fight, end of quote, over rents as small businesses struggle to cope with substantial ongoing costs but zero revenue?
The same response. I just want to warn the member that when he uses a general question like that, it's very easy to relate. But none of his supplementaries yet have. Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, we're well aware that for many small businesses, having no revenue has been a huge struggle. That's what the wage subsidy scheme was about. It's why it was paid as a 12-week upfront lump sum in order for businesses to be able to plan. We continue to work with small businesses on what else we can do.
Does he think it's fair that under government policies, that small business operators have been told by the government to close in the national interest, and yet they should be taking so much of the economic pain on behalf of the entire community?
It's been the recognition from the government from day one that we all needed to work together to be able to get through this. That's why we are very pleased by the fact that more than $10 billion has gone out the door to support businesses and workers. It's why another $12 billion worth of support via the tax system, the business loan guarantee scheme and many other initiatives have been put in place as well.
Supplementary, what hope can he offer Wellington bar owner Andy Gray, who told the Epidemic Committee this morning that under government policies so far, support has been, quote, not very much use?
Mr. Speaker, there are many different views, I'm sure, within the community. Myself and other government ministers are in receipt of people who have described the support that's been provided as a lifeline, Mr. Speaker.
Question number three, Kiritapu Allen.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. What actions is the government taking to support New Zealand businesses and households to respond to and recover from COVID-19?
Speaker, the best economic response to the virus has always been a strong public health response. That's why the first wave of our response is aimed at fighting the virus and cushioning the blow of it on our businesses and households. We allocated a $500 million fund early on in our response to strengthen our health services to fight and contain COVID-19. In addition, we have provided $10.5 billion in wage subsidies, meaning affected businesses receive support directly from the government to keep their staff on. A $2.8 billion income support package for our most vulnerable, a $2.8 billion of business tax changes to reduce cash flow pressure, $6.25 billion business finance guarantee scheme, and a suite of other measures to support businesses, including the $3.1 billion tax loss carryback scheme. Mr Speaker, we've put in place a safety net for as many Kiwi households and businesses as we can, and these immediate measures will mean we're all in a better position to bounce back on the other side of this crisis.
Interesting. How is the government developing a plan for the New Zealand economy in the wake of COVID-19?
Speaker, the second wave of the government's economic response plan is to position for recovery and kickstart the economy. As we move into level three, many more parts of our economy are opening up to work. The government is working with sectors across our economy and society to develop recovery plans as we move further down the alert levels. This includes the Infrastructure Industry Reference Group and in areas such as housing, training, Māori and Pacifica response, tourism and the media. Ministers are tapping into all the ideas and talents New Zealand has to offer, including from our businesses, entrepreneurs, academics and unions. Through these plans, the government will provide a kickstart to economic growth as restrictions ease further and as we move further towards a new normal.
What steps is the government taking to ensure New Zealand's long-term economic recovery?
Mr Speaker, as we look ahead, we must be aware of what our economy could look like. The crisis represents an opportunity to reset and rebuild our economy. There are some long-standing challenges which we will continue to face, including low productivity, inequality, climate change and a lack of diversity in our export markets. We know we now have a chance to reorient our economy and society, and we want to take these opportunities and tackle these problems. We have formed a macroeconomic response group of ministers, including the Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister, myself and Minister Parker, to guide this work. And this work will also include a critical role for the private sector, unions, NGOs and others. Mr Speaker, our long-term plan is to build a productive, sustainable and inclusive economy that protects the long-term wellbeing and living standards of all New Zealanders.
Question number four, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. What percentage of identified COVID-19 close contacts who have been contacted to date were contacted within 3 days?
The Honourable Dr David Clark.
Mr Speaker, the most up-to-date data I have available covers the period 13 to 17 April. From the information provided to me by the Ministry of Health, I can confirm to the House that 36 cases were identified as having close contacts. A total of 120 close contacts were followed up. 79% of those close contacts were traced within 48 hours and 91% were contacted within 72 hours.
Speaker. A point of order, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
An interesting answer that didn't address the primary question. The Minister has chosen a date range of 4 days out of the 60 days since our first case.
Yeah, he did address the question.
What percentage of identified close contacts of COVID-19 cases who have been contacted to date between the 29th of February and the 23rd of April, which is the last available date, were contacted within 3 days?
Mr Speaker, I have just provided the House with the most recent data available, but I would note that until recently there was no national database for contact tracing as it was all being done by local public health units. And this government has done what no government before has done. With the establishment of the National Close Contact Service, we are now gathering national data, and as such we're getting a better access to an overall picture. Moving into the future, we will have that data in a much more granular fashion than it has ever been provided before.
Wasn't the data in a more granular fashion, given the importance the government has placed on early contact tracing?
Mr Speaker, because, as I noted, no government had ever set up a national contact tracing system. The steps forward in terms of the IT solution that supports that is going to be incredibly valuable as we move into the future. And because of the efforts of nearly 5 million New Zealanders, we're in a unique, almost in the world position, where we have the opportunity to stamp out this virus. And into the future, we will be able to have a very clear picture of how quickly that is happening.
Confirm the advice given to him in the Ministry Situation Report number 83, that of the 10,093 close contacts identified, just 5,560 were traced at all, a success rate of just 55%.
Mr Speaker, at present the average time to contact people is 1.1 days. And my expectation is that as we continue to contact trace 80% of cases within 48 hours, we will see a picture that we want to see as a nation of success.
To the Minister, how many of Dr. Aisha Verrill's 6 urgent or critical recommendations on contact tracing reporting have been fully implemented?
Mr. Speaker, they are all being urgently implemented. The member can see from the data that I've just provided that we now have measures about how quickly contacts have been traced. And the picture in recent times is a very, very encouraging one. The bigger issue actually currently is the time taken between people first having symptoms and then getting a test done. That is our big challenge ahead. And what all members of Parliament can do is encourage their constituents, members of the public, to seek a test at the very first hint of any symptoms.
Question number 5, the Honourable Todd McLean.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Small Business, what official estimates has he received, if any, of small business failure and job loss as a result of the Level 3 and 4 COVID-19 restrictions?
The Honourable Grant Roberts.
Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, official estimates of the type that the member is asking for are not available at this time. The member will be aware that the Treasury has recently provided scenarios for the public showing how the economy could respond in the future to a range of different COVID-19 response levels, and obviously this includes a range of levels of unemployment. We can say that as at last week, 33,000 more people had applied for the JobSeeker benefit since the 20th of March. How many of those are related exactly to SMEs is not currently available. We also know that at least 70% of the $10 billion wage subsidy scheme has gone to small and medium enterprises. We will continue to work with SMEs and representative organisations to support them.
Thank you. To the Minister, will there be direct cash flow grants to help small businesses meet mounting cost pressures and growing debt to reduce the number of businesses that fail and the resulting avoidable job losses?
Mr Speaker, as evidenced by the many initiatives we've already put in place that support small and medium enterprises, we continue to look for ways to do that again in the future.
Will there be direct financial assistance to small businesses and landlords to help them with their lease and rent arrears to reduce the number of businesses that close and resulting avoidable job losses?
Mr Speaker, as the Prime Minister indicated earlier, the suite of measures we put in place have been, to this point, fairly universal. There is now the opportunity for us to work with small businesses and particular sectors in the economy on what the best response is to support them to get through this. We remain committed to ensuring that as many New Zealanders as possible stay in work and as many New Zealand businesses as possible continue to operate.
Why can supermarkets open under Level 3 restrictions, but butchers and greengrocers cannot?
Mr. Speaker, as again the Prime Minister has already said today, Level 3 is still a restrictive level. We are still trying to limit the number of interactions there are between people. We, of course, are seeing a very large number of businesses open for contactless commerce today, and judging by things that I've seen in the media, many businesses are taking that up, as are many customers.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Supplementary to the Minister, can he confirm that during Level 4 we unfortunately did have cases of COVID-19 within essential services like our supermarkets, thus proving how important it was to reduce down the potential contact of too many individuals outside those essential services so we could manage as best we could any potential transmission?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I can confirm that. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, that's a subset of the overall view that most small businesses in New Zealand take, which is that if we can do this once and do it right, that means we can get back to a new normal of commerce that looks much more like what we've seen in the past.
David Seymour.
Has the government then considered it might have reduced the spread within essential services such as supermarkets if people were able to access butchers, bakers and fresh fruit and vegetable stores instead of driving further to bigger, more crowded stores such as supermarkets?
Mr. Speaker, I already answered this in my earlier supplementary question. The whole point of both Level 4 and Level 3 is to reduce the amount of contact that people have with one another and to break the chain of transmission.
A point of order, David Timmer.
Mr. Speaker, he has not addressed the question. The question was not whether we're trying to reduce transmission, but whether a particular...
Order. It was addressed right at the beginning.
Thank you, Todd McLean.
Why has the government given $50 million in relief to the media, but not delivered any specific direct financial assistance for small business?
Speaker, I utterly reject the second part of that question. Billions of dollars is going out to support small and medium enterprises, both through the wage subsidy scheme and also the various other initiatives we've undertaken.
Question number six, Jenny Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Social Development. What initiatives has the Ministry of Social Development implemented in support of the government's response to COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Carmel Sivaloni.
Mr. Speaker, we acted early in March, establishing rapid response teams initially in areas feeling the greatest economic impacts, but subsequently across all MSD regions. We temporarily removed stand downs to ensure timely access to income support. The government announced an increase in main benefits of $25 per week, as well as a doubling of the winter energy payment in 2020 as part of phase one in our recovery package. MSD has also stood up the wage subsidy scheme with the support of IRD and MBI, which has supported over 1.6 million New Zealanders stay connected with their employers, as well as established the COVID leave support and essential workers leave scheme. MSD has gone to great lengths to also adapt its core services to ensure it continues to be responsive to people across all COVID alert levels. They have streamlined benefit application processes so people could apply and be approved online or over the phone, and continue to redeploy people into work where possible. On top of this, we announced the $27 million to support our social services. As a government, we have acted quickly to get support to New Zealanders who need it, and MSD have been an integral part of that response.
What recent initiatives has the Minister announced?
Mr. Speaker, today I announced a suite of initiatives that build on our already existing employment focus and the work of MSD's rapid response teams. I announced the Keep New Zealand Working online recruitment tool, an easy and free-to-use service where employers and employees can connect to recruit and find work. I also announced 35 new employment centres across the country, a Keep New Zealand Working Fast tracking service for those on benefit who are able to re-engage quickly with the job market, and working in partnership with industry to provide quick upskilling solutions, for example, the new free online community health courses with NZQA unit standards. As we continue to respond to the impacts of COVID, MSD will continue to be agile in refining its employment-focused offering to ensure those who can are able to work.
What employment activity has been happening over recent months?
Mr. Speaker, these new initiatives I've just spoken about complement MSD's existing employment services and contribute to the government's broader employment strategy, which I'd like to acknowledge my colleague Minister Jackson for his leadership on. Over alert level 4, MSD's employment focus continued. MSD placed 6,648 clients into employment in March, and so far this month MSD has placed 2,478 people into work. Even during this very restricted period, MSD has found innovative ways to continue to support and connect people to opportunities for redeployment and work.
Question number seven, Dr. Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Associate Minister of Health,
how many flu vaccines have been ordered and how many have been administered to New Zealanders this year.
The Honourable Julianne Genter.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This year's flu campaign will be the biggest on record in New Zealand, with 400,000 more vaccines available in 2020 compared with last year. This means that 1.768 million flu vaccines have been ordered for New Zealand. By necessity, the initial order was undertaken well before the COVID-19 pandemic. As at 17 April 2020, 587,000 people have been vaccinated. This is more than double the 290,000 who had been vaccinated on the same date in 2019.
Supplementary, what percentage of the four priority groups for flu vaccine were administered the vaccine by the original deadline, and what percentage have now been vaccinated?
Mr. Speaker, I don't have those numbers with me right now, but if the member puts a question in writing, I'm sure that we can get something to him. I can confirm that there have been extremely high levels of vulnerable people vaccinated, so two-thirds of the vaccines entered into the NIR are people over the age of 65, over 5,000 are pregnant women, and we also know that there are record numbers of DHB frontline health workers have been vaccinated.
Supplementary. What communications has she had with the New Zealand Medical Association to understand their concerns after they described flu vaccination administration as a debacle?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I completely understand that this situation of unprecedented demand during a global pandemic would have put extra pressure on nurses, GPs, and pharmacists who are working on the front line. The Ministry of Health has stepped in with the distributor to ensure flu vaccines are getting to those who most need them. But I mostly want to thank all of those frontline health workers, the GPs, the nurses, the pharmacists, who have achieved this incredible result of twice as many people so far vaccinated as the same year, as at the same date last year.
Supplementary, how much influence on supply has it been with respect to flu vaccines administered to private payers who did not qualify for the free vaccine?
Sorry, Mr. Speaker, I'm not sure I caught the beginning of that question.
How much influence on supply has it been with respect to flu vaccines administered to private payers who did not qualify for the free vaccine?
Mr. Speaker, the government moved to start the flu campaign 2 weeks early this year, and we did that with the understanding that we would be able to ensure that funded people had an opportunity to get their vaccines early. And we extended that prioritization period out an extra 2 weeks. So there's basically been a 5-week period in which our expectation is that GPs and other providers were prioritizing the funded groups.
Supplementary. Will she make the flu vaccine free to essential workers, given her statement yesterday that all essential workers who are still at work, such as supermarket workers, should get the flu vaccine?
Mr. Speaker, PharmAct makes the decisions about who gets funded. This government did take the extra additional step of ensuring that we can cover the funding for aged care workers, as well as all health workers like those in DHBs. And ultimately, I would hope that the employers, the supermarket employers, are paying for the vaccine for their employees.
Dr. David Clark.
Can the minister confirm that recent data showed that around 1.2 million vaccines had been distributed this year, as opposed to just over 600,000 at a similar time last year?
Yes, that is correct. And indeed, 1.2 million is getting close to the total for the entire last season and was the total amount that were administered every year from 2013 through 2017.
Question number 8, the Honourable Nikki Kaye.
Mr. Speaker, question to the Minister of Education. Is he confident that the government has provided adequate support to education institutions, students and educators as a result of COVID-19.
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Tracy Martin.
On behalf of the Minister, not only am I confident, but considering the extremely unusual circumstances, I'm exceptionally proud that after only 5 weeks since the announcement that we would go into a level 4 lockdown, that the Ministry, the teaching profession, parents and students have taken us to a point where the majority of students are supported to enable distance learning, including the creation of 2 television channels. I want to acknowledge and thank all those that made this possible.
Mr. Speaker, supplementary question. With half of early learning centres indicating they will not open tomorrow, what advice has he been given about the expected numbers of children likely to attend ECN schools tomorrow?
Mr. Speaker, as of today, my understanding is that there is an estimated 6% of children attending who would normally attend ECE. I have on the back of some piece of paper here, there are 381 ECE centres open today, 1,322 children are attending. It is estimated that 3% of the normal student body will be attending school tomorrow, and that today is a teacher-only day, so at the moment there should be no children attending a physical school.
Supplementary question. What evidence can he give that there has been a full and thorough analysis of COVID-19 incidents at schools such as Marist and Pakuranga College?
Mr. Speaker, I would direct the member probably to send that question to the Minister of Health, as that is to follow up around COVID conditions is a Ministry of Health priority. But if she would like more detail from the Education Ministry of Education themselves around what cleaning has been done, what disinfecting has been done, what other parameters have been put in place, then I would invite her to put that in writing and I'll make sure she gets that detail.
Supplementary question. Is he confident that all schools and ECE in New Zealand opening both today and tomorrow have adequate access to PPE and flu jabs for educators?
Mr. Speaker, what I can tell the member is that all criteria by which ECE and schools are opening have been created under the advice of the medical experts. So with regard to those who need PPE, those who need other supports and other restrictions that have been put into place, they have all been created and have been passed out to the sector under the watchful eye of the medical experts.
Supplementary question. When will the government announce additional financial support for ECE, schools and tertiary institutions, given we have situations like students being locked out of their accommodation and charged inappropriate charges because their tertiary institutions can't survive?
Mr. Speaker, I have asked officials to meet with the NZUSA to look into this issue. They're meeting, I understand that they're meeting right now. I understand there is a varying practices across the country currently around charges at halls of residence at level 4 and level 3 when students are not living in their paid rooms, and I've asked for a picture of it all, as there are contracts and private provisions involved in some cases that need to be unpacked. And in the meantime, I'll repeat the Prime Minister's ask that we show compassion to each other in an unprecedented time.
Question number 9, Kieran McInaughey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Health, what public health measures are the key to the ongoing strategy to eliminate COVID-19?
Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, by going early and going hard, New Zealand has managed to stop community transmission of COVID-19 and eliminate the unknown spread of the virus for now. But we are not out of the woods. As other countries have seen, the virus can bounce back and resume its spread. That means we must continue with our strict border controls and use of quarantine. We must continue to test widely for COVID-19 and trace all close contacts of any confirmed or probable cases. We must continue to use self-isolation appropriately and follow strict rules around physical distancing. We've proven we can do this together. We must remain vigilant at alert level 3.
Entry. How have our health services responded to the challenges of eliminating COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, can I start by thanking the doctors, nurses, midwives and other allied health staff who have been at the front line and have continued to provide top quality care while adapting to new ways of working. I want to highlight two areas in particular where our health system has ramped up capacity: testing and contact tracing. In total, we have completed more than 120,000 tests, and we now have capacity to process more than 8,000 tests per day. That compares well internationally and gives us great confidence that we're getting an accurate picture of the extent of COVID-19. And in contact tracing, we have built from scratch the National Close Contact Service and an information technology solution to support it. The National Service can now make 5,000 calls per day, which can be scaled to 10,000, and public health units can trace 185 cases per day between them.
How can the public continue to play their part in eliminating COVID-19 at alert level 3?
Mr. Speaker, the public response to the challenge of COVID-19 has been remarkable, and I want to thank New Zealanders for their collective efforts and their commitment to stamping out this virus, and by doing so, saving lives. We cannot relax at level 3. While more people are now at work and there is some more movement within our communities, we need to follow the same sensible measures that have served us so well during alert level 4. Stick to your bubble, observe physical distancing, stay home if you are sick. And perhaps most importantly of all, if you have any symptoms of COVID-19, seek medical advice and get tested.
Andrew.
David Seymour.
Can GPs expect the remaining funding promised to their sector to be released, and when?
Mr. Speaker, I am aware that there is conversations ongoing between the Ministry of Health and the primary care sector around the nature of the costs they are facing with COVID-19, and there is a desire to work together actively to make sure that any additional costs that are being incurred are supported.
Question number 10, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and asks, does MSD have sufficient capacity to respond to requests for its services? And what extra capacity, if any, is being put in place to ensure all New Zealanders have access to support?
Mr. Speaker, during the lockdown period, MSD have continued to help very large numbers of New Zealanders. To give a sense of this, in the week to the 5th of April, MSD responded to more than 90,000 contact centre calls, and our case managers carried out almost 80,000 phone-based appointments and calls. In response to this demand and in anticipation of more New Zealanders needing MSD support, since the 18th of March, MSD has hired 279 new service delivery staff. We have also streamlined services to ensure that more can be done via phone and online, like the approvals of benefit applications. Where possible, we have worked across departments, like with IRD and MB, to establish initiatives like the wage subsidy and leave payment scheme. MSD has worked quickly to be responsive in an environment that has changed rapidly over the past months. I will be monitoring closely as things continue to change to ensure MSD is well supported to respond to New Zealanders during this unprecedented time.
Supplementary. What is the average time between an initial call and receiving a hardship grant?
Mr. Speaker, a hardship grant from memory last week when I got information on Friday, I think 73% were responded to received it within 2 days.
How many calls have been dropped?
Mr. Speaker, I don't know if any calls have been dropped recently. On Friday, also when I was speaking to the Chief Executive, I think that the average call time was around 54 seconds. That might have been for the day before on Thursday. A couple of weeks back, the demand was overwhelming. Some people were on the phone waiting for 2 hours, at which point they would have dropped off. And I think the average call time at that wait time at during that period was around 44 minutes. So it has improved significantly from an average wait time of 44 minutes to an average wait time, which last got reported to me, of 54 seconds.
What discussions has she had with the Salvation Army to follow up on their reports that said, quote, people are still struggling to access WINS and MSD online support, unquote?
Mr. Speaker, I respect the reports that are coming from the Salvation Army and the work that they are undertaking alongside many of the other social services that are out there. I have had at least one meeting with the Salvation Army and a range of other
organisations or Zoom meetings. And I think, I do believe I've got another one coming up, and I think they may be part of the church leaders social service group that I'll be meeting with. I take on board any constructive criticism that is sent our way. Intention is to do the best job that we can possibly for New Zealanders, and if constructive criticism comes from social services, then I accept it and we look at how we can do things better.
How many people who can't get through to MSD are turning instead to local EOCs, welfare centres, for support?
Mr Speaker, I don't think that we would have had an issue with people trying to get through to MSD in the last week at least, and potentially the last 2 weeks. There was just that week where we experienced a huge increase in demand, and that has petered off to a certain extent, Mr Speaker. Also, with the CDM response on the ground, what we have an agreement on with those localised efforts is that when they do the outbound calling or when they take inbound calls, they do establish whether or not people are eligible for MSD support first, and then put them in touch with MSD. In instances where they say that they haven't been able to get in touch with MSD, I've heard of cases where they've said, well, let's try, let's do this now, and where the CDM efforts are actually doing that.
Question number 11, the Honourable Todd McLean.
Thank you. To the Minister of Tourism, what official estimates has he received, if any, of business failure and job loss in the tourism and hospitality sector as a result of the COVID-19 Level 3 and 4 restrictions?
The Honourable Kelvin Davis.
Treasury has clearly outlined the various unemployment scenarios that could be possible as a result of COVID-19. Many of those job losses will come from the tourism sector. At the moment, Tourism New Zealand is undertaking a stakeholder survey which will provide more of an insight into the current state of the sector, how we work together to respond, restart and reimagine the tourism sector into the future.
Is he concerned that the government's wage subsidy does not go far enough to protect jobs in industries like tourism and event management, where business has been entirely closed for an extended period of time?
Mr Speaker, preliminary results from Tourism New Zealand's stakeholder survey show that 1,382 respondents, or 87%, had accessed wage support, including the wage subsidy and essential workers' leave payments, as well as 18% of respondents had accessed tax relief measures. 11% had access support to assist in assessing finance. We know that businesses are hurting and businesses in tourism are hurting, but the government has done the best it can to try and cushion the blow.
What reports has he heard of tourism businesses like Naitahu or Skyline or Tapuia having to close or reduce staff despite wage subsidies, the government's wage subsidy scheme?
Well, Mr Speaker, as the Minister of Finance has often said, that the wage subsidies and the business assistance package were there to cushion the blows, and he's also been very clear that we will not be able to save every job.
Your business? What specific action is he going to take now to help the tens of thousands of workers in the tourism sector who are facing job losses irrespective of the job subsidy?
Mr Speaker, Tourism New Zealand has been tasked with the job of reimagining the future of tourism. They're working alongside MB, DOC and stakeholders. A plan is coming together, and the member will have to wait and see exactly what that plan is in terms of us supporting the tourism sector into the future.
Question number 12, the Honourable James Shaw.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Question is to the Minister of Finance. Will the investments that the government makes to create jobs in the short term also help resolve long-term challenges that impose costs on future generations, such as the climate crisis and the affordability of housing?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, the investments this government is making as we position the economy to recover from COVID-19 will not only create jobs in the short term, but over the medium and long term as well. That's because our plan is focusing on sustainable job creation across a range of industries. This government has taken an intergenerational approach to how we decide what to invest in through our wellbeing approach, and that will continue as we look to the challenges that lie ahead.
Supplementary. Does he agree with the World Bank's Vice President for Infrastructure, Mr. Mukhtar Diop, that boosting low emissions transport through post-COVID investments will, quote, not only benefit the climate but also support long-term economic growth, create quality jobs and connect more people to opportunity?
Or any one of those.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I can agree with that, and indeed irrespective of COVID-19. While the recovery from COVID-19 allows us to do a stocktake of how we go about what we do and how we do it, I would stress that the government is already ahead of the curve when it comes to these types of investments. For example, the New Zealand Upgrade Programme announced at the end of January ensured that a number of unfunded ideas for transport projects were future-proofed into concrete plans by the current government to take into account the need to allow all forms of transport, including public transport, walking and cycling.
Does he intend to incorporate advice from the Climate Change Commission into his post-COVID economic planning? And if so, how?
Speaker, yes indeed. A wide range of advice is needed for the government to be able to come up with the plan that will support all New Zealanders through this and position us for recovery. I think in New Zealand we're extremely lucky to have a wide range of experts, in both economically, scientifically and otherwise, who can help us look to the future. And I've already seen Dr. Rod Carr's comments in that regard.
And does he agree that, as well as job creation and environmental benefits, investing in renewable energy like solar, wind and geothermal to electrify the vehicle fleet could also help our country not spend more than we earn overseas by reducing our approximately $5 to $6 billion annual bill for oil imports?
Mr. Speaker, I believe the member is referring to balance of payments, and I congratulate him for raising that particular topic in the House today. The government is already encouraging greater use of renewable energy, uptake of electric vehicles and other measures like greater investment in hydrogen to increase the use of renewable energy, and that work will indeed continue. Reducing imports does help to improve our balance of payments, but we shouldn't just stop there. New Zealand is in a strong position to build up our exports of products that are produced using renewable energy, which would also help the balance of payments.
That concludes oral questions.